Financial framework for an economy, a market economy. And some of the subjects we need to cover here are the rule of law, interventionism, and then all forms of socialism. Let me erase this first, and we'll talk about the rule of law to begin with. What do we mean by the phrase the rule of law? You've probably run across the phrase in your reading, but what exactly do we mean by that phrase? Well, it includes several subsidiary ideas. One is equality before the law. That's a part of the idea of the rule of law, equality before the law. And again, this grows out of the idea that all men are images of God. All men are creatures of God. We all descended from an original couple, Adam and Eve. Now, men have different gifts. They have different talents, different abilities, different educations, different backgrounds. We're not asserting that men are equal in any respect, except that they're all treated by the law as being equal. No special privileges. No special penalty. Because you're blue-eyed, or because you're blonde, or because you were born in England, or whatever it might be. No special privileges, no special penalty. There's equality before the law. This is one of the ideas that is contained in the idea of the rule of law. There's no aristocracy. See, even a nation like England has an imperfect idea of equality before the law because it retains an aristocracy. It has people who have titles, lords and dukes and barons and earls. It has all these gradations, legal gradations. In the U.S., the Constitution prevents, it prohibits any titles of nobility, because it's interested in equality before the law. It's a very basic idea. There's another thing prohibited in the Constitution. No ex post facto laws. Can anybody tell me what ex post facto means? After the fact, okay? After the fact, no ex post facto laws. Again, something very common, very basic. That is, you don't make up a law after the fact and say, this deed is now forbidden. For an act to be punishable, for a deed to be punishable, it has to be a crime at the time it's committed. You can't make up a law after someone's done something and say, this is now a crime and we're making it retroactive. No retroactive laws. No ex post facto laws. Now, keeping in mind what we've said about the planning for the future, obviously if there were such a thing as ex post facto laws permitted, no one could do any planning with any expectation that his plans were not going to be outlawed, or his deeds or his activities were not going to be outlawed the day after tomorrow. Now, can anybody think of how this principle of no ex post facto is violated today? Yes, sir. Well, would you explain that? Was RICO, the Racketeering Act, was it made retroactive? It was? Well, then that would be an example of it. If Congress says in passing this act, let's say Congress passes the act, I'm not sure when it was enacted, what, 1992 or several years ago. They said in passing this act, we're going to make it effective 6 months earlier. That's an ex post facto law. If they pass a law like that and put an earlier effective date on it, that's precisely what's forbidden in the Constitution. Yes, sir? They do. Precisely. Precisely. They make them retroactive. That's a common thing with tax law. They make them retroactive. This disrupts planning, obviously, of many sorts. It's the idea that Congress or some legislative body can go back and outlaw something in the past, or change the regulations that applied to something in the past, so that what you did in the past, in good faith, as a legitimate, as a legal act, is now forbidden, or is now regulated, or is now taxed, or something of that sort. No ex post facto. Yeah, that's the phrase the Constitution uses. Now you're getting warm. The courts frequently don't pay any attention to the Constitution. You can go through law school and not take a course and read the Constitution. You may read all sorts of cases, but to actually sit down and read the Constitution, you can go through 3 years of law school and not do it. but this is a central idea in the rule of law. It says the rule of law holds that the law is fixed. It's stable. And you do not go back and change the law and make it retroactive. There's another phrase the Constitution uses. No bills of attainder. Now, what's a bill of attainder? In fact, they use it. There's a phrase that goes along with it, corruption of blood. No bill of attainder or corruption of blood. This is a type of law that's forbidden in the Constitution. What's a bill of attainder? Anybody? It's a law aimed at a specific person. It's saying the legislature cannot function as if it were the executive. It cannot go after a specific person. All men have to be treated equally. So Congress cannot write a law aimed at Bill Gates, for example. Now, they have tried, over the centuries, they've tried to do exactly that sort of thing, though, and they try to do it in a very sneaky way. They won't mention the person's name in the law, but they'll give such a description, such a definition of who this law applies to, that it's going to apply to just one or a few people in the whole country. And they've attempted to get around this prohibition in the Constitution in that way. And this is obviously, again, an attack on the idea of equality before the law. There's another idea in the rule of law, due process. Due process. What does that mean, due process? Have you ever heard the phrase, every man has his day in court? That's sort of a colloquial way of saying due process. That is, you can't simply throw someone in the slammer. Yes? Right. And you have the amendments stating what that due process is. You know, jury trial, right to jury trial, right to speedy trial, protection of against self-incrimination, protection of your papers, protection of your effects, all of those things are part of due process. Where do we get due process from? Well, it comes from, again, Scripture. If you'll turn to the book of Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew, it's sometimes overlooked in the passage that I'm looking for here, but God himself engages in due process. And certainly if anyone had a right to execute punishment without due process, it would be God on Judgment Day. Look at Matthew chapter 7, beginning at verse 21. And again, this is one of many examples in Scripture. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name, cast out demons in your name, and done many wonders in your name? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. Now, we read this sometimes so quickly that we overlook what's going on here. Now, these folks, in the day of judgment, are permitted by God to make their plea. They have their day in court. He doesn't just summarily dismiss them and send them to hell. He knows that they are sinners. He is the sovereign. He's the absolute judge of the world, and he would have every right to summarily dismiss them and send them to hell. But he allows them to make their plea. He says, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name? This is all the evidence they're giving for why they should be allowed to get into heaven. Have we not prophesied? Have we not cast out demons? Have we not done many wonders in your name? Here you have an illustration of due process. He's acknowledging their plea. He permits it. And if anyone had a right not to, it would be him. All the more so ought our laws to reflect due process. Well, there's other ones. In the rule of law, some of these are stating the idea in another way. The rule of law is general rules. General in the sense that they apply to everyone. They're stable. They're not ever changing. Has any of you ever heard of the Federal Register? Okay, can you tell me what it is? You know what the Federal Register is? Well, not the laws. It's the daily book that is printed by the government printing office containing the new regulations for that day. You have not only a body of law passed by Congress, enacted by Congress, but you have the regulations proposed and put into force by all the executive and regulatory agencies. And in order to centralize things, the government printing office prints a book 5 days of the week, 9 by 12, 8.5 by 11, something of that dimensions, on newsprint, 3 columns of fine print, about 200 pages a day of new regulation. Every day, 5 days a week, 52 weeks a year. New regulations issued by the federal government. Lawyers in Washington, some lawyers make an excellent living doing nothing but keeping their eye on the Federal Register and advising their clients of new regulations that affect their businesses. They work for major corporations, they work for trade associations, they work for unions, they work for all sorts of institutions in the economy, and they're paid very well because their job is to be sort of the first alert system for new regulations that are being proposed or are being enforced by the federal regulatory agencies. They change every day. 200 pages a day of regulation. That's why I made the comment the other night that we have probably, all of us, violated laws we don't even know exist. And if some bureaucrat takes a dislike to us can probably find some way of charging us with some violation of a law or a regulation, because there are so many. And they're so unstable. They're continually changing. Again, this interferes with planning. This interferes with decision making. If you're going to plan for the future, the environment in which you plan has to remain stable. It can't be continually changing. Even the interference of Congress in passing new laws, 200 new laws a year in Congress, is destabilizing and interferes with economic development, simply because it interferes with people planning. Now, some businessmen who might be called political entrepreneurs have gained some wealth by anticipating what the government's going to do. They use their information as to what bills are likely to be passed or what regulations are coming down the pike in order to make decisions based on what the government is going to do. Some political entrepreneurs, like Donald Trump, the real estate tycoon, he uses government money for his investment. Government grants and subsidies and loans for his investment. He's not what you might call a market entrepreneur. He has close ties with governments and has achieed great wealth in that fashion. But again, this interference with the stability of law interferes with the rule of law. It transforms the whole system into what is called the rule of men. That's the contrast with the rule of law, the rule of men. Now, again, if I might use God and the Ten Commandments as an example. God, if anyone, has the right to rule just by giving a decree. And he can change them every day if he wished. But he doesn't. He gives 10 commandments, and they're permanent. He's not going to come out with another commandment tomorrow saying, well, forget those 10, or he's not going to come out and reverse himself, say, no, you don't have to love me after all, I was just kidding. Nothing like that. You have a legal framework that is stable, that is clear, that is understandable, intelligible, all the things that law in the United States today is not. The legal system is, and the laws that apply to each of us are neither stable nor intelligible. I mentioned the example of antitrust laws the other night, where it's illegal for a businessman to set his price anywhere. Completely illogical. And it makes economic development, or it thwarts economic development, and certainly inhibits it. Now, let me draw a line up here, because I want to try to correct one misapprehension that is very common in society. I'm going to draw a simple line, if this thing will work. There we go. And at this end, I'm going to write the rule of law. And over here, I'm going to write socialism and anarchy. Socialism we've defined as the government ownership of all the means of production. Anarchy is the lack of law altogether, the lack of order in society. In the middle, we have interventionism. Or the mixed economy. Now, there are various forms of socialism. And we need to keep this clearly in mind. Communism is a form of socialism. Nazism is a form of socialism. Fascism is a form of socialism. And anarchism itself is a form of socialism. Most anarchists, with the exception of some recent ones, most anarchists are socialists. Have been socialists. The great anarchist writers of the late 19th and early 20th century were socialists. Yes, sir? Yes, I would. Now, the opposite here, the point I'm trying to make is the opposites of the rule of law are socialism and anarchy. Socialist societies are lawless societies. They're lawless societies. The dictator or the planning group makes things up as they go along. What is permissible today may be impermissible tomorrow. In fact, tomorrow the dictator may make what was permissible today impermissible today. He'll have ex post facto laws. He'll have bills of attainder. Certain people will have certain privileges, other people will be punished. All these violations of the rule of law. This is a lawless society. Frequently you heard it said that Nazism was right-wing and communism was left-wing. That's nonsense. There is no sense in talking about right-wing and left-wing anymore. The only time it made any sense was at the time of the French Revolution, when the right-wingers supported the monarchy and the left-wingers didn't. Since then, it's been a useless distinction. And beware of anyone who tells you that Nazism is the opposite of socialism or communism. Nazism is socialism. The name of Hitler's party was the National Socialist German Workers' Party. The National Socialist German Workers' Party. He was a socialist, a national socialist. A different variety from the international socialists of Hitler, of Stalin, but he was a socialist. The word Nazi is simply the first two syllables of the German word for national, national. We didn't want to say the whole name of the party, so we shortened it to the Nazi Party. First two syllables of the German word for national, the National Socialist German Workers' Party. What's the distinction between Nazism and fascism and communism? Well, the distinctions are these. The communists said, we are going to not only control private property, we are actually going to take legal title to it. We're going to take legal title to it. So when they took over in the Soviet Union in 1917, they actually destroyed the titles to the property. They said, we own it now, and they destroyed the historical title to property. Hitler came along in the 1930s, and he said, well, it's enough that we control private property. You can keep your titles, you can keep your paper documents, we just won't pay any attention to them anymore. Put them away, you won't be using them, because you will do what we say, you will do what Der Führer says. And he asserted a socialism of control of the means of production. The communists asserted a socialism of ownership. He asserted a socialism of control of the means of production. The economic effect is the same. But there is that difference. I had a teacher in college who said that, as far as he could see, the major difference was that the communists wore black shirts and the Nazis wore brown shirts. And otherwise, they're pretty similar groups. But they do have this distinction, at least in theory, that the communists said, we will take outright ownership of property, and the Nazis said, we'll be satisfied with the control, but you will manage your business, you will manage your firm as we say. To this fascist approach, Mussolini did the same thing in Italy. To this fascist approach, Hitler added some racism. And that was what made Nazism distinctive, was Hitler's racism. But they are all types of government control. They are all types of socialism. They are all lawless societies. They are societies in which you are awakened in the middle of the night by a knock on the door and taken off to prison and never heard from again. That thing could happen in an anarchy. That thing does happen in anarchy. Socialist societies are sort of anarchist societies, that is, lawless societies, in which there is just one thug that you have to deal with. And he's managed to win the battle in the streets. Now, we are somewhere in between here. The United States at the present time is somewhere in the middle. We have left, we have abandoned to a great extent the rule of law, and we have been moving for most of this century toward lawlessness. Lawlessness in government, lawlessness in society. That's the direction we've been moving. Now this mixed economy, or this interventionist economy, or interventionist society, is unstable. It's unstable. It's not a third option in between these two. Over here you have capitalism and the rule of law. Here you have interventionism, and over here you have socialism and lawlessness. This in the middle is not a third option. It's an unstable situation. And it will resolve itself in one direction or the other. It will resolve itself either toward the rule of law and capitalism, or free market economy, or the private property order, whatever phrase you'd like to use, or it will resolve itself here toward socialism or further government control, further lawlessness. And how it resolves itself depends on you. How it resolves itself depends on you. What you're thinking, what people of your generation think, whether you understand the roots of the moral order, whether you understand the theology that gave us Western civilization, whether you understand the principles of economics, the principles of government. How this turns out is going to depend on you. In the providence of God, the next generation or two, I'm convinced, is going to see a resolution one way or the other. We're either going to continue our journey to socialism here and end up in a thoroughly nasty society, or we're going to recover what we've lost in the past 100 years and develop a moral order, a godly society, a society based on law, a society based on scripture, a society based on freedom. This will not continue forever. It's an attempt to combine private property with government control. It's an attempt to combine private activity in the market with government regulation. And this attempt is unstable by its nature. You see in the past few decades enormous amount of turmoil in society. You see lawlessness growing in that sense. You see government becoming more and more lawless. That doesn't mean we're without laws. You can have plenty of laws and be lawless. Means that there is no rule of law. There's no stability. There's no general law. There's no legal framework that you can count on for planning for the future. Yes, sir.
Do there a method to move towards the rule of law? It seems like the last time we did that was with the International Revolution. Is there any way to do that? Do we have a pattern for that at this point?
Well, so long as we are free to speak, so long as we're free to publish, there definitely is. What has to be done is people have to begin to understand these ideas themselves and then talk about them. Talk about them. Talk about them with your neighbor. Talk about them with your children. Talk about them in the press. So long as we're free to speak and publish and assemble, so long as we have those freedoms, yes, there is always hope of peaceful resolution in that thing. Well, I don't know. That's hard to pick out a point. I suppose the Civil War changed a great deal in the U.S. Some of it for the good, some of it for the bad. And what you have seen since the Civil War, for the most part, has been a growth in government control. And don't get me wrong, I think Lincoln was a great man. I disagree with many people about Lincoln. I think Lincoln was a great man. But Lincoln, at the beginning of the war, took certain actions as chief executive that were obviously unconstitutional. He suspended habeas corpus. That's one of the, we didn't mention that, but that's part of due process. An obviously unconstitutional act. And that sort of, what shall we say, activist executive has been part of the problem ever since. The idea that the president has that moral authority, if not legal authority, has the moral authority to go outside the law to achieve good purposes, whatever those good purposes might be. And those change with every president.
Yeah. We are going away from the rule of law, which is like when our courts don't uphold our highest law of the Constitution, we ignore the Constitution, and destroy the rule of law, and our individual section or parts of the government function as their own government rather than under the umbrella of the overall Constitution, such as our children's
Well, there are many examples of that. We didn't mention as part of the rule of law the idea of a separation of power. The idea is expressed clearly in the Constitution in that you have three articles and three branches, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. So you have agencies today that have assumed all three powers to themselves, the Internal Revenue Service. The Internal Revenue Service writes its own regulations, it enforces its own regulations, and it adjudicates its own regulations. And this is, that's not the only example, but it's one of the worst examples of this disappearance entirely of a separation of powers. You find, again, the separation of powers in Scripture. And it's not a new idea that Madison came up with just out of his mind of genius in 1787 at the Constitutional Convention. That's not how the idea originated. But we've abandoned that idea to a great extent. So you have that Children's Services or Children Protective Services acting in violation of the rule of law. Yeah. With the IRS, you're presumed guilty until you can prove you're innocent. Not presumed innocent until you can prove you're guilty. Or somebody can prove you're guilty. So that's just a couple of examples. Read a good history book on the development of government power in the U.S. and you'll find many more examples of them. I don't know. Everyone who holds office under the Constitution takes an oath up to it, whether they're federal or state officials. Everyone who holds office takes an oath to the Constitution. And the presumption is, of course, I guess, that they've read it and understand it and agree with it. And I'm not sure we can make that presumption, but how you would enforce it, I have no suggestion. Let me, in the last 5 minutes here, let me explain one other thing to you. It's one of the functions of the Constitution, certainly one of the functions of the U.S. Constitution, is to prevent the majority from ever considering certain questions. It's to prevent the majority from ever considering certain questions. Being Democrats, small d Democrats, we believe in majority rule. But the majority doesn't decide what's right and wrong. A majority rule, you'll find it again in the New Testament, in the churches, decides some useful questions like who will hold office. But majorities are never called upon to decide questions of right and wrong. And one of the functions of a constitution, a written constitution, is to prevent majorities from doing that. This principle is extremely important because when we've reached the point in our history that we have now reached, where people are receiving checks from government, benefits from government, whatever form they might come in. Let me try to explain it as best I can. Let's say we have, 40 million people receiving Social Security checks. 40 million getting Social Security checks. Now there you have a significant voting block of people who have an interest in seeing the tax and expenditures of the government continue. You have a significant voting block here with 40 million people getting the checks. If the Constitution had been observed, we would never have been put into the position of having 40 million people receive checks from the government. But now we're in a very difficult position, because it would appear that to correct the situation, you've got to convince 40 million people that it's in their best interest to end the system. We've created an interest group here that is going to vote for larger and larger Social Security benefits. Let's take a different example with another type of thing that happens. Let's say we have peanut producers, the peanut growers, and they get price supports, price subsidies. And let's say those price subsidies, I'm not sure what they actually get, but let's say they get $5 billion a year. $5 billion a year for peanut producers. And let's assume, to make it as simple as possible, let's assume that there are, 10 million peanut producers. I'm sure there aren't that many, but let's assume that. Well, each peanut producer gets what? $5,000? $2,000? Let me do the math quickly in your head. Do this into 5 million. What is it? We cross out seven. They get $500. Yeah, I put billion up there. Okay. Yeah. So they get, each one gets $500. And they have an interest in this program because they're going to get $500 for it. Now, there's 100 million taxpayers in the country, 10 times as many as peanut producers, 100 million taxpayers. But what's it going to cost each taxpayer to pay this peanut subsidy? Right? So as a taxpayer, it's worth at most $50 to you to end this peanut subsidy. If you're a peanut producer, it's worth at least $500 to you to continue the program. Now you're going to see why, now you're going to begin to understand why these special interest groups hire lobbyists and lawyers to go to Capitol Hill and testify that we really need to continue this subsidy. And you're also going to see why very few people oppose them. The consumers, you and I, are going to be willing to shell out at most $50 to stop this one program. But they are going to be willing to shell out $500 to continue the program. And if we reduce that number of peanut producers down to where it probably should belong, it'd be much more than that that they'd be willing to pay out. You see the economics here of intervention. They have a great incentive to keep the program going, but each individual taxpayer has a very small incentive to stop it. And it's precisely this sort of situation that a constitution is supposed to prevent by not allowing questions like this to come up for majority vote. We're in the difficult situation here of having created a group here, another group, with an economic interest in the continuation of the system. And those taxpayers who oppose it are scattered. They'll probably spend $50 finding someone else who's interested in ending the program. And they won't have any money left to go to Washington. Now, for $50, you can fire off some telegrams, and that's about it. You're not going to hire a lobbyist or a lawyer or a law firm to oppose the program. But the special interest group, because there's fewer in number and their subsidy is divided among fewer people, they have the incentive to do it. Yes, sir. Many members of Congress, you could tell who they were going to vote for by who contributed to their campaigns or which lobbyists they talked to last. That would be the determination of how they would cast their votes. Well, that's not the case in Washington. It may be the case at the state level. But Washington is flooded with mail. They get thousands of letters every day. But again, the interest of the taxpayer, he has no economic incentive to stop any one program. Now, overall, he may have an incentive to stop the whole system. But to stop any one of them, he has very little incentive. And that's why the system continues and grows. Until there's some way that the incentive system can be rearranged, until members of Congress start to read the Constitution and understand their obligations and their oath, there's probably not going to be much change in the proper direction.
The only point that he's trying to make to us, we have to put a rule, or not a rule, but right against the rule, but the citizens is within the balance. But he said that lobbyists don't have to send a lot of people, who don't have to know these special interest people, don't have to get a lot of lawyers going, just a few. And he said that would combat all their what they're doing. It wouldn't take very many citizens to overwhelm them beyond what the lobbyists are doing. Yet, we don't even put that type of influence. In other words, if 50 people were to write on one particular bill, and the lobbyists only had 12 different special interest people coming in, we can't come to the 50.
You might. But again, you have this disparity in incentives, so you don't get your 50 people. Any other questions or comments?
Yes, sir.
Do you have an opinion on the Federal Reserve System and the morality of it?
I think the Federal Reserve System is both unconstitutional and immoral. I guess that's an opinion on it. I think it ought to be I think it ought to be sold. It ought to be privatized. It certainly, when Congress created it in 1913 again, there was no constitutional warrant for it. There still isn't today. And what it has done over the decades is given us the worst depressions and the worst recessions and the worst inflations in our history. It's ironic because if you look at the arguments for the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1912, 1913, it's supposed to give us a stable money and iron out the difficulties in the economies. And ever since then, it's given us the worst fluctuations in virtually every area of the economy that we've had in our history. The panics of the 19th century don't compare to what the Federal Reserve has managed to do. There's no warrant in the Constitution for it at all. There's no warrant in economic theory for it at all. It should simply be eliminated as a government agency by selling it. Just like we ought to sell the public schools. Sell the public schools. Sell them to the highest bidder. Yeah. And what's that?
On your not so simple line.
Yeah.
You said we're somewhere in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
That we're going to go one way to the border. Do you have any idea in your thinking to what you're going to target?
No, your guess is as good as mine. I see hopeful signs of the growth of Christian schools, the growth of private schools, the growth of homeschooling. I see hopeful signs there. I see the growth of technology is a hopeful sign. Everybody getting a computer, everybody becoming their own publisher, almost. I see that as a hopeful sign. But I also see things that aren't so hopeful. So it's very difficult to tell. Which way?
If you're saying that information is actually a very positive thing,
yeah.
Truth, or
if we're courageous enough to speak it. If we're going to just sit around and keep silent, hoping that we don't suffer, then we deserve what we get. But if we're courageous enough to speak the truth, preach the gospel, explain things to our neighbors, engage in discussions, then yes, truth will always have that an effect on society. Anything else? Well, it's been a pleasure to me. I hope you've had half as much fun as I've had this week. I thank you all for your attention and for coming. And I look forward to seeing you again sometime.
Before you leave, would you help us back the chair along the wall?
If you're ever in...